thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 63 for the 9th of December, 2010. Never do anything that involves human beings.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Digital Campus, episode 63, where public intellectuals become podcast intellectuals.
Or we try, at least. We try to become intellectuals, that is.
Exactly.
Well, in any case, intellectual or not, this is where you can get all of your commentary on the technology news and its possible effects on colleges, universities, libraries, and museums. And we're joined by Dan Cohen, director of the Center for History and New Media, and New York Times darling.
That's
Dan.
That is my middle name, Amanda. Thank you very much.
You legally changed it, right?
I'm going into hibernation. I'm overexposed at this point, so probably shouldn't even be on this podcast. I'm so glad you're hosting. I'm so glad you're hosting, Amanda. Great to have you hosting.
Yeah, I should mention that I'm Amanda French. I'm that camp coordinator for the Center for History and New Media, making my maiden voyage as a chief host of Digital Campus. So be kind. Don't rewind.
Welcome to the host chair.
Thank you. We're also joined by Tom Scheinfeld, managing director of the Center for History and New Media, the fastest emailer in show business, I mean higher education.
Hey, everybody.
And Tom, you just gave a talk at CUNY on digital humanities, didn't you?
I did. Yep. I borrowed the stuff star-like meme, the stuff white people like meme, to talk about stuff digital humanists like with the group there at CUNY. A great audience. A lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounded great. And you put a great near transcript of that up on your blog that I much enjoyed reading.
Yep, indeed.
That was great. And we also have Mills Kelly. And Mills, you're fairly recently have become the director of the Global Affairs Program at George Mason. Is that right?
That's right. Another in my seemingly unending series of administrative head bashings, meaning me getting bashed over the head. But no, it's actually, it's been very rewarding. And I'm upstairs from the history department now, just one floor.
That's great. And speaking of blogs, I also really enjoyed your blog post on Facebook and human trafficking. That was really eye-opening. I was lucky enough to go to a session of your course on human trafficking a month or so ago, and it was really fascinating.
Yeah, that whole I spent some time this weekend searching around to see. One of my students had written a very good paper about Facebook and human trafficking and Facebook and other social networks. So I decided to poke around a little myself just to sort of verify some of the stuff that was in the article she'd cited, and it's really pretty disturbing, actually.
Yeah, the part where you said, you know, a lot of people want to use Facebook for educational technology purposes, and I'm not really comfortable with that, given that you can get sensual massages and things like that on Facebook. That was
I mean, I had actually one of the pages I found myself at yesterday while doing some more of this research was so unsettling that I actually had to email it to somebody I know in the FBI and say either this is a hoax or it's really sad. So Facebook clearly has some algorithms to write to try to comb through their however many tens of millions of membership pages to deal with some of this. I mean, they can't police every single page, but there's got to be some kind of an algorithm that can help.
It's so funny, too, because I always think of Facebook as kind of a, I don't think of Facebook as having a seamy underside much. You know, you compared it to Craigslist, and everybody's kind of aware of that sort of thing going on Craigslist. But Facebook looks so clean and blue and white that you wouldn't think of it visually.
Yeah, but if you unfortunately, if you want a prostitute, Facebook's a really good place to find one.
Well, on that
once again
note,
Digital Campus Podcast, serving our community of listeners.
That's right.
Well, on to the big news over the last couple of weeks. I think last time on episode 62, we had discussed a little bit with Jen Howard of the Chronicle where the Google eBooks store was. It used to be called Google Editions, but it is now renamed Google eBooks, and it launched this week. Dan, you want to give us your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it sort of just came out of nowhere. I mean, I'm surprised they didn't really have a... It's interesting that they had a big press conference for Chrome OS, which maybe we'll discuss later in the podcast. But am I wrong? They didn't really have a big event for this. They just sort of said, here it is. They had a press release, but I don't think they really had as big a publicity push as I would have expected for this thing. Am I wrong about that?
I don't remember. That's right. Yeah,
I think they just sort of said...
They might have had some kind of an event, but it wasn't a big... It wasn't one of these big, you know, rent out the Moscone Center in San Francisco kinds of events.
Yeah, which kind of surprised me because... You know, just on the surface, there's so much me-too-ness to it in terms of, you know, the store itself looks freakishly like if you shop for books on an iPad, it's exactly what you see. It was a little bit harder to tell, like, what are the differentiating points without poking at it quite a bit. So just for the listeners who haven't checked this out yet, now when you go to books.google.com, they've actually changed the homepage for Google Books to have two different search engines. One is for what I guess you'd call traditional Google Books, which is their library digitization project where you can access, now I think it's up to 15 million books that they've digitized in the last 5.5 years. That's on the left side. On the right side, there's the store. It's interesting that it's not a single search box. So there's two different search boxes, and you can search for books to purchase and download to devices like the Kindle or the iPad or the Sony Reader, or actually read it on the web. And if you go into that search box, you get a kind of browsing thing where they have bestsellers and things like that. I did notice one really interesting thing between the Apple bookstore and the Kindle bookstore and Google ebook store, which is that there are no staff selections, which tells you a lot about Google and that they never do anything that involves human beings. You know, when there's not an algorithm lying around, they're not going to have it. So it's interesting that there's not that, at least an attempt at the, you know, we're going to pick it for you. Of course, that is, I think, part of something larger, which is that all along they've been saying that this is going to help save independent bookstores because it will provide them a kind of back-end infrastructure to set up their own ebook stores. So Powell's, it was one of their launch partners, Powell's, the big bookstore that a lot of people really love and that has withstood the onslaught of Borders and Barnes & Nobles and Costco book sales to survive. So they launched with their own website that you could buy Google e-editions. And smaller stores as well. I think a lot of people in New York were interested in the Word bookstore. It's just called Word in Brooklyn, where they also had a bookstore ready to go. And evidently they sold more e-books in the first day than they sold all last year using this infrastructure again. But, you know, even just using that word infrastructure, it just struck me right away that really the accomplishment here is they've, you know, set up a kind of cyber infrastructure for distributed ebook sales, and they're not selling a device like the Kindle where they're locking you in. But, you know, I think to the end user, you know, if you're not an engineer or you're not a bookstore, it's going to seem very Me Too-ish, you know. It's just another place where you could kind of go and get, a Stephen King book for $9.99. And I didn't really find a lot of differentiating elements. And I came out of it worried a little bit that it wasn't even going to accomplish the goal, I think the very laudable goal of providing a sustainability model for those independent bookstores, which I thought was going to be getting some kind of big cut for referral sales. But it looks like each bookstore has to price their ebooks themselves, which immediately led a lot of people to notice that, for instance, Google was selling some books for $9.99 that Word in Brooklyn was selling for $18.99 or $27.99. So in that way, it may end up being that it just provided another huge competitor along with Barnes & Noble's and their Nook store and Amazon with their Kindle store and Apple with the iBook store. It just provides a fourth giant ebook store that people will go to first before they go to the indies. So I guess I came away a little bit confused about really what the purpose was, other than to provide some kind of massive infrastructure for 3 million books to serve on multiple devices.
Yeah, I also think that there's an issue with, you know, I guess I'd agree with the assessment that it's sort of too little too late, in that there's also the issue of, you know, a couple of years ago when you could only read your Kindle books on your Kindle, and Kindle really was a closed platform. I mean, it's still not an open source format or anything, but it's also not really as closed as it used to be either. I mean, you can read your Kindle books on your Kindle, or you can read them on your Android device or your iPhone or your iPad or you know, almost any device. The Kindle books are available everywhere. And so, you know, so while to us who know about these things, you know, we know that the Kindle format is DRM'd and closed and all of that, but like to your average user, right, you can use the Kindle books wherever you want to use them. And so it's sort of open in that sense. I don't see really how much this adds. I think Google's another big competitor in this space, but I don't think it really adds to, you know, the choice of consumers terribly much.
Well, and I have to say, I played around with it today before the podcast, and there's still some clunky aspects to the interface. I mean, if you create, you have to create a bookshelf for books that you want to save. If you're trying to organize them, you have to create that bookshelf first. And then as you save the book, if you're buying a free book, you have to then designate which bookshelf it's going to go into, or which folder in your account it's going to go into. Once you've saved it, if you haven't done that, there's no clear and obvious way to take that book and put it on one of your bookshelves. It's just, if it's there, I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it in the help. And I'm reasonably adept at technology. And so that's still a little clunky.
But isn't it, it's surprising to hear all this in a way, you know, this dull thud talk, given that, you know, the worries about Google eBooks sort of putting libraries out of business and, you know, all that. I mean, what, is it only the interface and the UI features that are making it less worrisome than we had thought it would be? Or is it just that we've had so much action with ebooks this year in things like the iBook store and Kindle in various ways?
Well, I mean, I think the idea is that ultimately, for instance, any publisher, small or large, or author could come to Google and make an arrangement to sell books where, you know, theoretically there's a play for openness here where anyone can kind of come in and it's more of an open bazaar. Prices can be set at different levels. Different cuts of different prices can be set. Again, I think it just remains to be seen whether that really pans out in practice. Sorry, Tom, I interrupted you.
No, I agree with that. I mean, the idea of this open bazaar, I mean, I think the experience of the last couple of years in ebooks and in digital music, for that matter, sort of shows that, you know, people don't necessarily really care about there being an open bazaar. I mean, you know, like, people are pretty happy with iTunes, you know, even though the software is pretty clunky. I mean, people are pretty happy with it. People are pretty happy with the Kindle store. I don't know. And I hate this feeling, but I can't avoid the sort of sneaking feeling that this is just too late for the indies. You know, it's just, this isn't going to save independent booksellers. Like, there just aren't that many of them left, and the competitors are just too big. And you said, Dan, like having Google in the mix, I'm not sure that helps them. I'm not sure having you know a fourth big competitor in the mix helps independent booksellers.
Right. I mean, they seem pretty happy about it in some way. But I just what I wonder is this. So they've gotten crushed by the big guys on the high end, right? Your Barnes and Nobles, your Costco, your Costco's, your and now the you know the online systems like Amazon and Apple. But then I kind of worry about if we move to an online world where the quote unquote indie is basically a recommendation system. In other words, it has knowledgeable staff that highlight, you know, really great books that you want to read this weekend. And so you are loyal to them, not physically anymore, but you go to their website. So you go to wordbrooklyn.com or what, I can't remember the URL. And that's where you look up the books and that's where you buy your eBooks. There's two problems with that. There's still the problem of you go there, you find the selections, then you go over to Google and get them for $20 less, right? Or Kindle or iBookstore or whatever. So there's that. But then I wonder if they get nibbled at the low end by, let's say, a very knowledgeable reader who sets up a blog that recommends one book a day and gets their cut of, in other words, they set up an ebook store. And now you've got all these, you know, tens of thousands of, in a sense, one person, quote unquote, bookstores competing with the indies from below in the recommendation, in the kind of personal recommendation space. And that's also enabled by the Google thing. So I still don't get, you know, I'd love to see independent bookstores have a sustainability model, but I don't really see how this helps. I mean, maybe I'm being thick about it. But
here's the other thing I'd say about this is that, you know, which independent booksellers is this going to help? I mean, I can actually see how this might, that you know, this might allow, you know, give Powell's and Tattered Cover in Denver and Word in Brooklyn. I mean, it may give them a lifeline and they may survive and they may make money on this. But I mean, but then, so then we end up with like half a dozen big independent booksellers too. Like, I mean, I sort of see it as consolidating the independent book market. Like it puts the independent bookseller in Worcester, Massachusetts out of business because now I can go to Powell's.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Into like, competition with each other. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so you end up with consolidation in that market as well. So we may end up saving half a dozen big independent booksellers, but then they start looking a lot like Barnes and Noble.
Well, before we move on though, I want to just ask if by independent booksellers, you also mean university presses. And you know, how is this going to affect university presses at all? Which, you know, granted are not bookstores, but have been sometimes trying to sell particularly ebooks directly from their own websites and so on. Do you think this will help them at all?
University presses were conspicuously absent, I thought, from the launch. I looked for some books. I obviously, egotistically, I checked out my two books from Penn and Hopkins. The one from Hopkins is available for the Kindle, but it's neither of them were available, at least at launch, on the Google bookstore. So I wonder if this is the other kind of interesting thing. They seem to be negotiating individual contracts with individual producers. And there's kind of a curtain there. You know, with the big five, they negotiated a 70%, 30% split, 30% to Google. They say that other publishers are getting 52-48. And I kind of wonder if behind the scenes, you actually have to kind of deal with, you know, well, if you're not big enough, then you get a lower cut, and they're not quite providing the same deal to everybody. So there's some secrecy there. Hey, Amanda, could I sneak in a couple things on this that I did notice that are good for the academic market?
You bet.
Before we move on? You know, one thing that I did notice is, on the negative side, there's no cut and paste. So that's not very helpful for scholarship.
You got to be positive now.
Yeah, but okay, sorry. I'll get to the positives. So, okay, the first thing is they respect canonical page numbers for the first time. It's the first ebook store that when you download a book, and I tried this out, you get, if you resize the text, which all of these things allow you to do, the Kindle app, the iBooks app, all allow you to do this, but they destroy the page numbers in the process. In other words, you change a book from 300 pages to 1,000 pages, you have no idea what the original, you know, what quote unquote the original pagination is if you wanted to, let's say, cite an academic book that you were reading. In the Google bookstore, when you're reading a book and you resize the text, it does reflow the text, but then at the bottom, it gives you a span. So it'll say, you're now on page 101 to 105. Mm. And then, so right there already, you're in a better position than all these other stores. And then you can actually unflow the text and get the actual citation number for that particular page. So, you know, I think they have thought, there was a lot of thought behind this launch, I think, for the academic market. And it was actually interesting that they said at the launch that they were also working very closely with textbook makers. And so I think we're going to hear a lot more about that as well as they come online, because it may be a very preferred store for textbook makers. So I do think there's a lot going on there. The third thing I'd say on the positive side is, after all, you're getting 2.5 million public domain books in really nice readable shape. So, you know, people who've got an iPad, it's, you know, it's a great system now once the app is on the iPad to grab a public domain book. And it's got a nice toggle between the way the book originally looked and just the EPUB version, which just shows the text. So you can flip back and forth seamlessly between the historical book that was digitized, you know, an 1890 book, and the extracted OCR text. So, you know, I think there's some positive things here for academia.
Well, I'll just mention too that one of the great things I thought about this release is that it released books to the open web. I mean, those books were already on the open web, but it's, you know, once you have a whole kind of app that's associated with it and the model of a store and the model of things you can buy, you know, in copyright books that you can buy and read on the web, I actually thought was really important, because not everybody wants to buy an e-reader. And granted, almost everybody hates reading books on the web, but sometimes you would rather put up with the inconvenience and annoyance of that than spend $600 on an iPad, you know? So, but the, right. The only thing is that breaking news just last night, Amazon announced that it opened its Kindle books to the web, because previously you couldn't read Kindle books just in a browser. You could only read them, you know, with a Kindle or with a Kindle app. And, you know, this is very, very fresh news. So I don't know how this is going to play out at all, but just,
well, but maybe that's the, maybe that's actually the best thing about this, is that it, you know, there's competition in the marketplace, and hopefully it will push innovation and push people to, you know, push Amazon to do things better and push Apple to do things better. And they'll all, things will improve because there's more than one player in the market. Maybe that's the big story.
Well, that's a wonderful optimistic note to move on from, to a just crazy, crazy big story that's been all over everything in the last week or so, WikiLeaks. Mills, WikiLeaks seems like global affairs. What's your take on WikiLeaks?
You know, I have to say I'm probably an outlier on this one, but I'm a believer that transparency is good for government and good for democracy, and that more rapid transparency in government documents is good. You could make the argument about the WikiLeaks leak. That, of course, okay. I have to back up here. The downloading of all of those documents was illegal, and that was a crime. So, and it wasn't classic whistleblowing. It was somebody who was just pissed off at the government, who downloaded everything he could get his hands on and then passed it along to somebody else. So I'm not condoning criminal activity because that's wrong. It's against the law. The specifics of this case, I think, are problematic. I think the larger issue of much more rapid disclosure of government documents is one that is going to get lost in all of the shouting about compromising national security or whatever. I think sites like WikiLeaks will continue to proliferate. I think it's too easy to get a hold of various kinds of government, corporate. I mean, you know, the next thing WikiLeaks says is, you know, a major American bank. I think that might be, I might have a slightly different opinion about private corporate documents for individual private documents, but government documents are the property of the people who are served by that government. And yes, there are national security questions which can be compromised, and that can be problematic. But in general, I'm in favor of rapid disclosure of all government documents. And the current system in the United States and in most democracies is far too restrictive to have to wait 25 to 50 years for citizens of the government to have access to things like diplomatic cables. Is just absurd.
That's an interesting distinction, which I don't know that I had ever or had recently heard, you know, that distinction between actual whistleblowing and what happened here, which it wasn't as though somebody wanted to expose a particular, piece of misconduct. It was just, you know, we're going to take this huge dump and make the whole thing public and let people sniff around in it for misconduct or scandal or gossip.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And and whistleblowing is protected in the United States in a whole variety of ways. It's not always fully protected, but there are various protections for whistleblowers in the United States and in at least some other countries. But, to say that diplomatic cables coming from the embassy in pick a country should be sheltered from public view for 25 years or more does not serve the public interest in any way, because what it means is that debate about crucial issues for our country or any other country is limited to the little bits of information that come from those who actually have seen the documents. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee gets to see whatever they want to see when, you know, in real time, as fast as the documents could be copied or now emailed over to them, they can see all those cables. Well, so then senators get to debate the merits of American policy in, say, the Middle East or in sub-Saharan Africa based on whatever knowledge they're willing to reveal to the public. The public has to – we're getting a third hand at this point. And then we have to form some kind of, you know, carefully considered opinion about American foreign policy. It's just simply not possible until 2.5 decades later, at which point half the people involved are dead. The policy has played itself out, and we can say, oh, that's why we did it. I'll give you a very specific example of why this is also an issue for historians, is that and the Chronicle Review had a piece sort of along these lines this week. People in my field of endeavor, East European history, ended up looking kind of dopey after 1989 and the 1991, when a lot of archives in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union were opened up. And the issue that they ended up looking dopey over was the Prague Spring of 1968. The prevailing interpretation was that Brezhnev, the Soviet leader, freaked out over the democracy reforms in Czechoslovakia and basically press ganged the East European states in the Warsaw Pact to send their armies into Czechoslovakia along with the Red Army. Romania stood aside for their own reasons, but basically, you know, the East Germans, the Poles, the Bulgarians, they sent their troops in. And it turns out that that's completely wrong. Once the archives opened, what really happened was that the leaders of Poland and Hungary and Bulgaria and these other countries, they freaked out over what was happening in Czechoslovakia because they didn't want to enact those kinds of democratic reforms. And so they pleaded with Brezhnev to please send in the Red Army. Well, you know, for 2.5 decades, these leaders had been happy to say, oh, well, Brezhnev forced us into it. And that was the prevailing interpretation in the West. And then we got to see the documents, and it turns out all those books are just flat out wrong. Why did we have to wait? Now, I know why we waited there, because it was a dictatorial regime that wasn't going to open its files, and then it took an actual peaceful revolution to make that difference. But in a democracy, why should people have to wait this long, as long as we currently have to wait? It's just absurd.
So in some ways, you're saying that if the government, say even somebody like the National Archives, would open up things like these cables earlier, what do you think? How long a space do you think? Then we wouldn't need things like WikiLeaks,
you know, right? I don't know why we have to wait more than a year. And you could say, well, that negotiation is still ongoing. You know, we're still in a sort of a tricky phase in that negotiation, so we're going to sit on those for another 6 months and say we're going to release these documents as soon as the negotiation is complete.
Right. Well, I think it may be. I mean, this particular tranche of documents seems. I mean, a lot of it seems pretty, you know, mundane. I mean, I you know, the New York Times and other major papers have combed over this for weeks now, and the things they've come, you know, and we're not talking about anything.
Months. They got this stuff in the summer.
Right. So for months, they've been combing over this, and we're still not talking about any of the content of the documents. We're talking about WikiLeaks, right? So these documents are pretty mundane, which sort of suggests that, like, well, why weren't they released in the first place? Like, they're not sensitive. And so I actually think the story here is that, you know, maybe it pushes the needle a little bit in the direction of transparency. I think, right, the default position of the government now is to keep it secret. And that shouldn't be the default position of the government. The default position of the government should be make it public. And if there's a good reason not to make it public, then don't make it public. And I'm sure there are some of these cables that should be kept secret. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of cables that should be kept secret for 25 years. And there are good reasons to do that. But it seems that most of them, including most of the ones that were leaked over the last couple of weeks, they're just boring, right? There's not anything particularly newsworthy in them. And there's no reason why they couldn't be made public.
Yeah, and this is this default position has been the default position of the U.S. government since the Second World War. Before the Second World War, it wasn't so much, but since the Second World War, it has been. I mean, back in my MA days doing diplomatic history, I was working in the archives of the Office of Foreign Funds Control, a World War II agency that was tasked with controlling all foreign funds in the United States. Basically, it was an economic warfare branch of the Treasury Department. And at the conclusion of the Second World War, the need for this sub-agency no longer existed because the war was over. And so they boxed up all their archives. It was over 400 boxes of materials. And what did they do? They slapped a classified sticker on every single one of those boxes and shipped them over to the National Archives. So, and from then until the early 1990s, when I started looking at those boxes, nobody opened them. Now, partially because people weren't so interested, but to look in those files, which turned out to be of great interest to attorneys trying to recover assets looted from Jews in Europe by the Nazis and others, that you had to have a clearance to get to those documents, which I happened to have back in the early 90s, and so I could look at them. And, you know, it was the whole thing, it was just crazy that this stuff had been classified. And it's just because they were shutting down the agency and they were in a hurry. The war was over. And so they just, the simple thing to do is slap a classified sticker on every single box.
I remember once somebody was, it wasn't Sonia Sotomayor, but somebody was up for some presidential appointee position in the U.S. government, maybe U.S. Attorney General or something like that. And I noticed that they released all of her email records. And so I went and I browsed through some of her emails. And it was kind of hilarious how many of them were on the level of, sure, 5 o'clock is good for me. You know, they were so boring. You know, I thought, wow, you'd really have to be very dedicated to comb through these to find evidence either that she is or is not a good person for whatever position she was being considered for. And so it actually always calls to mind for me Roy Rosenzweig's article about how you operate as a historian in a world where there's such abundant information. But beyond that, I have to say that one of the interesting things about this WikiLeaks story for everybody, not just for us, are the difficulties of the site in continuing to operate, so that it seems like a number of internet principles are kind of at stake. There were all kinds of they had difficulty finding an ISP to continue hosting the site. MasterCard and Visa refused to allow WikiLeaks to continue to use their services. So what do you guys think about this story and its effect on basic principles of freedom of speech as enacted on the internet?
Well, I mean, if you read nobody reads terms of services, terms of service, and neither do I. But if you read the terms of service for something like, Amazon's S3 and EC2 services, or for PayPal, which is another one that cut WikiLeaks off, if you read the terms of service, they can basically, they can shut you down for whatever reason at any time, and there's not really a freedom of speech protection in any of that. They, you know, you agree to these terms, you use them at their pleasure, and if they want to cut you off, they cut you off. And so, you know, I think it's just, you know, something we all should be aware of when we sign up for services. I mean, you know, we all do it. We all use them. We use Dropbox. We use Twitter. We use Google Docs. We use all these things. And I think the lesson is that, you know that you're signing up for a service. You know, you're not buying a property when you sign up for these things. You're signing up for a service that can be canceled at any time.
Yeah, interesting. Well,
what did you all think of the issue of just a kind of final word on this, of sort of in the future, what diplomats will do? Because here's where I really felt conflicted. I think this is in some ways a tension between the needs of present day researchers and the needs of future researchers, because my gut is, if I was a diplomat right now, I'd be writing the most boring cables possible or picking up the phone. You know, it reminds me of what happened after Enron, you know, where companies started telling their employees, like, not to email anything, to pick up the phone or to use secure IM channels that weren't, that had no logs. Are we, you know, in our zest for transparency today, are we kind of destroying the future historical record by making all those people hesitant? Alexis Madrigal of The Atlantic kind of emailed me and he said, you know, I just see no proof of that. But I don't know, my gut as a historian and looking at archives and seeing how much has disappeared, I do worry about that. Either of you or any of you have a sense of that?
I think what's going to, I mean, I read some of these documents, you know, the ones that were been highlighted in the media, and I just don't remotely have the time to go paw through WikiLeaks database right now. But what's going to disappear, I think, from the diplomatic cables is not the analysis of professional diplomats. And, you know, and Hillary Clinton had a great point in her press conference about this, in which she said, you know, if you read these the other way, instead of reading them for the salacious, gossipy stuff, what you see is just how talented American diplomats are, that how acute their analysis of political and social circumstances in the countries where their work is. I mean, I do some teaching at the Foreign Service Institute, and I got to say, the people in the seminars that I work in, I mean, the State Department hires incredibly smart and talented and focused people. And so I think they will continue to write really acute and worthy cables about what's going on in their countries. And I think what they will stop doing is this kind of salacious, gossipy stuff.
Right.
And is that bad? I don't think so.
Right. But you don't think, you know, you talked about this kind of turning points in history and finding really critical information. You don't think that the most critical stuff, I mean, sure, the just general analysis of what is going on in North Korea, you know, those are like academic papers and why not make those public? But what about the, I don't know, you know, like the really touchy things?
It's the stuff they don't intend to be important. That
I don't think they put that stuff in the cables anyway. I think that happens on the phone. Yeah. We'll make up a scenario. The commander-in-chief of the North Korean army, through some kind of a back channel, approaches the American ambassador in Seoul and says, I'm about to stage a coup, and I want to know that the Americans will stand aside during the time of disruption that this will cause. And if they do, then after a period of 2 years, I'll begin negotiations for a permanent peace and reunification. Okay. You think that that those details with that name in it are going to go into a cable? I don't think so.
Right.
I think instead,
right,
a cable is going to come from Seoul saying, you know, I need to talk to the secretary.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe the general will poke the secretary on Facebook.
Yeah. Oh, and the other thing is, you know, there is also a process by which senior government people like the Secretary of State, if they get a phone call like this, notes are made, and those notes are stored. Now, whether they're stored online, that may not happen. You know, they may not be stored in a digital form for this very reason. I think overall, though, the balance in favor of transparency is has gone too much the other way. I mean, in the last decade, the government, the United States government, has attempted to reclassify documents that were already in the public domain. And so, you know, we've got this just sort of mania for the classification of information that has gotten completely out of scale, and this is why we end up with something like WikiLeaks.
Yeah, that's my feeling, is that WikiLeaks itself may not be a good thing, and I think probably it probably isn't. But to the extent that it pushes us away from that equally radical position that everything should be secret, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to something a little less weighty. And Tom, maybe you can tell us a little bit about Chrome OS and the announcement of that this week by Google.
Right. So, I mean, Google sort of re-announced Chrome OS this week. I mean, they made this announcement. They first announced Chrome OS, I don't know, 18 months ago or something. And it was it's essentially a new operating system based on the Chrome web browser that will almost, you know, it's almost not an operating system. It basically replaces the operating system with just a web browser. And it's designed for mostly smaller laptops, netbooks, that kind of thing. And it will be free, and it will be very lightweight. So it'll be almost instant on. You open the cover of your laptop, it'll turn on almost immediately. And it will basically just give you a selection of web apps. It won't really have any internal or require any internal storage to speak of. It won't have any native desktop apps per se. The desktop will be the web browser. And the applications that you use will be things like Gmail and Twitter and things, you know, web apps. So it's sort of a new model where the browser become the operating system. You know, a couple of thoughts about this. The first one is, I don't quite understand Google's strategy here with relation to its other operating system, Android, which can also run on, theoretically, it's been done in proof of concept, but you could imagine a laptop running on Android. It certainly is running on tablets. It's running on phones. What is the relationship of Chrome to Android? I don't think they've explained that that relationship clearly enough. It could be, and it sort of seems to me like Chrome and Android were announced originally around about the same time, that there would be, you know, Chrome OS, and these were two kind of skunkworks projects at Google. Android came to market much more quickly and has been a tremendous success for Google. Chrome OS seems to have lagged, and in the time that it's taken Chrome OS to hit the market, the computing landscape has really changed, and mobile devices and Android in particular have really made a name for themselves. And that's the direction that kind of lightweight, instant on, always connected computing is going. And so I'm not exactly sure where the market for Chrome OS is.
Well, it's interesting because I've heard a number of people make that point, you know, that what is the difference between Android and Chrome OS, and it always, you know, naively seemed sort of obvious to me. I was like, well, Android is for phones and Chrome OS is for netbooks. And, you know, and one thing I found interesting about this announcement was that Google announced hardware at the same time. There's like, here's the Chrome laptop. And again, it makes a kind of an interesting comparison with Google eBooks, because Google eBooks did not announce its own e-reader device, which in a way they easily could have. You know, obviously they probably wouldn't build it themselves at Google, but they could have, you know, hired somebody to design and do one. And there's been no rumblings about that. But here's
what I don't understand about that, though, Amanda, is which device is Chrome OS replacing? Okay, so you have your small device, your phone that you're carrying, right? You have your laptop, which does a whole bunch of things, does a whole lot more than any phone or any iPad or tablet can do. And then you have your primary web content consuming device, which is your, let's say, your iPad or your Android tablet. Which of those does Chrome OS compete with? Where does it fit into my digital lifestyle? Or is it a fourth device that I now need to own? That's what I don't quite understand, because I don't see it as, you know, as my primary web content consumption device, I want a tablet. As my on-the-go device, I want my phone. And as my, you know, workstation, to the extent that I still need one, and I think you still do need one, I want, you know, my Windows or Mac OS or Linux laptop, which has desktop apps that work really smoothly and run really quickly and have tons of features and, you know, video and audio editing software and all those kind of rich applications that really still don't work in the cloud. So which of the, that's what I don't get, is like, which of those does Chrome OS compete with or replace?
Right. Yeah, that, yeah.
Who knows? I mean, wasn't this conceived in the brief golden age of the netbook, which I think historians will look back at as between, let's say, February 2009 and June 2009? I mean,
exactly when I bought one.
Right, exactly. Right, yep. That was when like Asus, the EPC was going crazy and everyone was getting it. And then I just think in 2010, and maybe this will be a topic for our year-end roundup and future cast next time. But you know, I think that just the tablets just sort of sucked all the air out of that market, and you know, but they kept working on it. And to me, it seems to me, I mean, there's still a big plus, I guess, if you're a student and you want a $199 laptop, maybe this becomes that. And if you just need something to take to class and you're taking notes in Google Docs and you're doing Facebook in another tab, then maybe that's this. But
see, I just don't understand. Like, even if you want that small, cheap laptop,
right,
why not just run Windows on it? Like, Windows runs, you know, Windows 7, their starter edition or whatever their most basic one is, it's really cheap. I think it's free, actually, to OEM, you know, to the makers to put on netbooks. And it runs, like, really fast, and it runs applications.
I have to say, I think Windows 7 is great.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I have to say, I may be a little more a fan of the netbook than you guys are. And I actually think that even for students, that's my sense, is that it might continue to be a really good option, because tablet devices for me are simply not really good input devices. They're wonderful content-consuming devices, but I really want something that I can actually, you know, write things on without having to buy a whole extra keypad and a stand and whatever. So for me, you know, and then something I can travel with. So I'm actually perhaps behind the curve, kind of planning to buy a netbook and, you know, eschew the tablet thing for a little while. And I'm going to take a close look at this.
I mean, there is the really cool aspect that you don't get in Windows or in a tablet or an Android device, where you have like a vanilla mode where you can open up a Chrome laptop and log in as a guest, and it just gives you a web browser, and that's it. And that's kind of intriguing.
It might be great for like libraries computer labs and stuff like that. I mean, it's almost like you don't need disk images anymore, and to like you know, ghost machines and all that kind of stuff. Like, you can just
I mean, like, I could see in it like a K-12 market. Like, my kids are in first grade, and
that's a great point.
They just had the visit from the laptop cart. Like, there's a cart that goes around that has 24 laptops on it.
I hate those carts.
And you know, and I've seen the laptops. Like, they're 2005 issue laptops. You know, but then you get this. It's like, I mean, I've seen my kids in front of a computer. Like, you could seriously mess up a computer, but I'm sure they have to ghost it with whatever Windows ghosting system they use. But this way, you could just like give them these cheap laptops, and you know, as long as you had everything as a web app, then you'd be okay. But maybe that's a big if.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on this, and it probably is time to wrap up. But as you mentioned, Dan, we are going to be doing a 2010 wrap-up episode.
Always our most popular show.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of comments. We need to keep the comments rolling in.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the summary of the summaries. The podcast give you a sort of quick intro into tech news for higher ed, etc. And then the year-end summary is a summary of that. So
it's like the Oscars, really.
The best of.
I'll be in a tuxedo. And
Oh, does that mean we're going over to videocast now?
We might. 2011, maybe the fifth year is our video year.
Wait, you guys don't dress up for every show?
I do have a bow tie on right now.
Well, that gives everybody something to look forward to. So thank you all for listening to the so well-dressed episode 63 of Digital Campus, and we'll see you next time.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself. Thank you.